The Third Eye by Tuesday Lobsang Rampa, read to you by Blue Friend. Chapter 16, Lamahood. A considerable amount of training was now given to me in the art of astral traveling, where the spirit or ego leaves the body and remains connected to life on earth only by the silver cord. Many people find it difficult to believe that we travel in this way. Everyone does when they sleep. Nearly always in the West it is involuntary. In the East, lamas can do it when fully conscious. Thus they have a complete memory of what they have done, what they have seen, and where they have been. In the West, people have lost the art, and so when they return to wakefulness, they think they have had a dream. All countries had a knowledge of this astral journeying. In England, it is alleged that witches can fly. Broomsticks are not necessary, except as a means of rationalizing what people do not want to believe. In the USA, the spirits of the red men are said to fly. In all countries, everywhere, there is a buried knowledge of such things. I was taught to do it. So can anyone be. Telepathy is another art which is easy to master, but not if it is going to be used as a stage turn. Fortunately, this art is now gaining some recognition. Hypnotism is yet another art of the East. I have carried out major operations on hypnotized people, such as leg amputations, and those of an equally serious nature. The patient feels nothing, suffers nothing, and awakens in better condition through not having to also suffer the effects of orthodox anesthetics. Now, so I am told, hypnotism is being used to a limited extent in England. Invisibility is another matter. It is a very good thing that invisibility is beyond more than the very, very few. The principle is easy. The practice is difficult. Think of what attracts you. A noise? A quick movement or flashing color? Noises and quick actions rouse people, make them notice one. An immobile person is not so easily seen, nor is a familiar type or class of person. The man who brings the mail, often people will say that no one has been here, no one at all. Yet their mail will have been brought. How? By an invisible man? Or one who is such a familiar sight that he is not seen or perceived? A policeman is always seen, as nearly everyone has a guilty conscience. To attain a state of invisibility, one must suspend action, and also suspend one's brain waves. If the physical brain is allowed to function or think, any other person nearby becomes telepathically aware or sees, and so the state of the invisibility is lost. There are men in Tibet who can become invisible at will, but they are able to shield their brain waves. It is perhaps fortunate that they are so few in number. Levitation can be accomplished, and sometimes is, solely for the technical exercise involved. It is a clumsy method of moving around. The effort involved is considerable. The real adept uses astral traveling, which is truly a matter of the utmost simplicity, provided one has a good teacher. I had, and I could, and can, do astral traveling. I could not make myself invisible in spite of my most earnest efforts. It would have been a great blessing to be able to vanish when I was wanted to do something unpleasant, but this was denied me. Nor, as I have said before, was I possessed of musical talent. My singing voice brought down the wrath of the music master, but that wrath was as naught to the commotion I caused when I tried to play the cymbals, thinking that anyone could use those things, and, quite accidentally, caught a poor unfortunate monk on each side of his head. I was advised, unkindly, to stick to clairvoyance and medicine. We did much of what is termed yoga in the Western world. It is, of course, a very great science, and one which can improve a human almost beyond belief. My own personal opinion is that yoga is not suitable for Western people without very considerable modification. The science has been known to us for centuries. We are taught the postures from the very earliest ages. Our limbs, skeleton, and muscles are trained to yoga. Western people, perhaps of middle age, who try some of these postures can definitely harm themselves. It is merely my opinion as a Tibetan, but I do feel that unless there is a set of exercises which have been so modified, people should be warned against trying them. Again, one needs a very good native teacher, one thoroughly trained in male and female anatomy, if harm is to be avoided. Not merely the postures can do harm, but the breathing exercises also. Breathing to a particular pattern is the main secret of many Tibetan phenomena. But here again, unless one has a wise and experienced teacher, such exercises can be extremely harmful, if not fatal. Many travelers have written of the racing ones, lamas who can control the weight of the body, not levitation here, and race at high speeds for hours and hours over the ground, hardly touching the earth in passing. It takes much practice, and the racer has to be in a semi-trance state. Evening is the best time, when there are stars upon which to gaze, and the terrain must be monotonous, with nothing to break the semi-trance state. The man who is speeding so is in a condition similar to that of a sleepwalker. He visualizes his destination, keeps it constantly before his third eye, and unceasingly recites the appropriate mantra. Hour after hour he will race and reach his destination untired. This system has only one advantage over astral traveling. When traveling by the latter, one moves in the spirit state, and so cannot move material objects, cannot, for example, carry one's belongings. The Aropa, as one calls the racer, can carry his normal load, but he labors under disadvantages in his turn. Correct breathing enables Tibetan adepts to sit naked on ice, 17,000 feet or so above sea level and keep hot, so hot that the ice is melted and the adept freely perspires. A digression for a moment. The other day I said that I had done this myself at 18,000 feet above sea level. My listener quite seriously asked me, with the tide in or out? Have you ever tried to lift a heavy object when your lungs were empty of air? Try it and you will discover it to be almost impossible. Then fill your lungs as much as you can, hold your breath, and lift with ease. Or you may be frightened or angry. Take a deep breath, as deep as you can, and hold it for 10 seconds. Then exhale slowly. Repeat 3 times at least, and you will find that your heartbeats are slowed up and you feel calm. These are things which can be tried by anyone at all without harm. A knowledge of breath control helped me to withstand Japanese tortures and more tortures when I was a prisoner of the communists. The Japanese, at their worst, are gentlemen compared to the communists. I know both at their worst. The time had now come when I was to take the actual examination for lamahood. Before this, I had to be blessed by the Dalai Lama. Every year, he blesses every monk in Tibet individually, not in bulk, as does, for example, the Pope of Rome. The inmost one touches the majority with a tassel attached to a stick. Those whom he favors, or who are of high rank, he touches on the head with one hand. The highly favored are blessed by him, placing 2 hands on the person's head. For the first time, he placed both hands on me and said, in a low voice, "You are doing well, my boy. Do even better at your examination. Justify the faith we have placed in you." 3 days before my 16th birthday, I presented myself for examination together with about 14 other candidates. The examination boxes seemed to be smaller, or perhaps it was that I was bigger. When I lay on the floor with my feet against one wall, I could touch the other wall with my hands above my head. But my arms had to be bent as there was not enough room to stretch them straight. The boxes were square, and at the front, the wall was such that I could just touch the top with my outstretched hands, again with my arms above my head. The back wall was about twice my height. There was no roof, so at least we had ample air. Once again we were searched before entering, and all we were allowed to take in were our wooden bowl, our rosary and writing material. With the invigilators satisfied, we were led one by one to a box, told to enter, and after we had done so, the door was shut and a bar was put across. Then the abbot and the head examiner came and fixed a huge seal so that the door could not be opened. A trap hatch, some 7 inches square, could be opened only from the outside. Through this, we were passed examination papers at the beginning of each day. The work papers were collected at dusk. Sampa was passed in as well once a day. Buttered tea was different, and we could have as much as we wanted by merely calling Po Shak Kesho, or bring tea. As we were not allowed out for any purpose whatsoever, we did not drink too much. My own stay in that box was for 10 days. I was taking the herbal examination, anatomy, a subject of which I had already a very good knowledge, and divinity. Those subjects occupied me from first to last light for 5 seemingly endless days. The 6th day brought a change and a commotion. From a nearby box came howls and screams, running footsteps and a babble of voices, clatter of a heavy wooden door being unbarred. Soothing murmurs and the screams subsided to a sobbing undertone. For one, the examination had ended. For me, the second half was about to start. An hour late, the 6 days' papers were brought. Metaphysics, yoga, 9 branches of it, and I had to pass in the whole lot. 5 branches are known very slightly to the Western world. Hatha Yoga teaches mastery over the purely physical body, or vehicle, as we term it. Kundalini Yoga gives one psychic power, clairvoyance, and similar powers. Laya Yoga teaches mastery over the mind. One of its offshoots is to remember permanently a thing once read or heard. Raja Yoga prepares one for transcendental consciousness and wisdom. Samadhi Yoga leads to supreme illumination and enables one to glimpse the purpose and plan beyond life on earth. This is the branch which enables one, at the instant of leaving this earth life, to grasp the greater reality and abandon the round of rebirth. Unless one decided to return to earth for a special purpose, such as to help others in some particular way. The other forms of yoga cannot be discussed in a book of this nature, and certainly my knowledge of the English language is inadequate to do justice to such illustrious subjects. So, for another 5 days I was busy, like a broody hen in a box, but even 10-day-long examinations have to end, and as the Lama collected the last papers on the 10th night, he was greeted with smiles of delight. That night we had vegetables with our Sampa, the very first change from this one basic food for 10 days at least. That night it was easy to sleep. At no time had I worried about passing, but I did worry about the degree of pass. I had been commanded to be high on the final list. In the morning, the seals were broken from the doors, the bars were lifted, and we had to clean our examination boxes before we were able to leave. For a week, we were able to recover our strength after the considerable ordeal. Then came 2 days of judo, in which we tried all our holds and made each other unconscious with our anesthetic holds. 2 days more were devoted to an oral examination on the written papers, in which the examiners questioned us about our weak points only. Let me emphasize that each candidate was orally examined for 2 whole days each. Another week, during which we reacted according to our temperaments, and then the results were announced. To my noisily expressed joy, I was again at the top of the list. My joy was for 2 reasons. It proved that the Lama Mingyar Dondup was the best teacher of all, and I knew that the Dalai Lama would be pleased with my teacher and with me. Some days later, when the Lama, Mingyar Dondup, was instructing me in his room, the door was thrust open, and a panting messenger, tongue lolling and eyes staring, burst in upon us. In his hands he bore the cleft stick of messages. "From the inmost one," he gasped, "to the Honorable Medical Lama, Tuesday, Lobsang Rampa." With that he took from his robe the letter, wrapped in the silken scarf of greeting. "With all speed, Honorable Sir, I have rushed here." Relieved of his burden, he turned and dashed out even faster in search of Chang. That message, no, I was not going to open it. Certainly it was addressed to me, but what was in it? More studies? More work? It looked very large and very official. So long as I had not opened it, I could not know what was inside, so could not be blamed for not doing this or that. Or so my thoughts went. My guide was sitting back laughing at me, so I passed the letter, scarf and all, to him. He took it and opened the envelope, or outer wrapping. Two folded sheets were inside. These he spread open and read, deliberately being slow about it to tease me further. At last, when I was in a fever of impatience to know the worst, he said, "It is all right. You can breathe again. We have to go to the Patala to see him without delay. That means now, Lobsang. It says here that I have to go as well." He touched the gong at his side, and to the attendant who entered, he gave instructions that our two white horses be saddled immediately. Quickly, we changed our robes and selected our two best white scarves. Together, we went to the abbot and told him that we had to go to the Patala to see the inmost one. "The peak, eh? He was at the Norbu Linga yesterday. Oh, well, you have the letter to say which it is. It must be very official." In the courtyard, monk grooms were waiting with our horses. We mounted and clattered down the mountain path. Just a little way farther on, and we had to climb up the other mountain, the Patala. Really, it was hardly worth the fuss of trying to sit on a horse. The one advantage was that horses would carry us up the steps almost to the top of the peak. Attendants were waiting for us. As soon as we had dismounted, our horses were led away, and we were hurried off to the inmost one's private quarters. I entered alone and made my prostrations and scarf presentation. "Sit down, Lobsang," he said. "I am very pleased with you. I am very pleased with Mingyar for his part in your success. I have read all your examination papers myself." That caused a shiver of fright. One of my many failings, so I've been told, is that I have a somewhat misplaced sense of humor. Sometimes it had broken out in answering the examination questions, because some questions simply invite that sort of answer. The Dalai Lama read my thoughts, for he laughed outright and said, "Yes, you have a sense of humor at the wrong times, but..." A long pause, during which I feared the worst, and then, "I enjoyed every word." For 2 hours I was with him. During the second hour my guide was sent for, and the inmost one gave instructions concerning my further training. I was to undergo the ceremony of the little death. I was to visit, with Lama Mingyar Dondup, other lamasaries, and I was to study with the breakers of the dead. As these latter were of low caste, and their work of such a nature, the Dalai Lama gave me a written script in order that I could keep my own status. He called upon the body breakers to render me all and every assistance in order that the secrets of the bodies may be laid bare, and so that the physical reason for the body being discarded may be discovered. He is also to take possession of any body or parts of a body that he may require for studies. So that was that. Before going on to deal with the disposal of dead bodies, it may be advisable to write some more about the Tibetan views on death. Our attitude is quite different from that of Western peoples. To us, a body is nothing more than a shell, a material covering for the immortal spirit. To us, a dead body is worth less than an old, worn-out suit of clothes. In the case of a person dying normally, that is, not by sudden, unexpected violence, we consider the process to be like this. The body is diseased, faulty, and has become so uncomfortable for the spirit that no further lessons can be learned. So it is time to discard the body. Gradually, the spirit withdraws and exteriorizes outside the flesh body. The spirit form has exactly the same outline as the material version and can very clearly be seen by a clairvoyant. At the moment of death, the cord joining the physical and spirit bodies, or the silver cord of the Christian Bible, thins and parts, and the spirit drifts off. Death has then taken place, but birth into a new life, for the cord is similar to the umbilical cord, which is severed to launch a newborn baby to a separate existence. At the moment of death, the glow of life force is extinguished from the head. This glow can be seen by a clairvoyant, and in the Christian Bible it is referred to as the golden bowl. Not being a Christian, I am not familiar with the book, but I believe there is a reference to "lest the silver cord be severed and the golden bowl be shattered." 3 days, we say, is the time it takes for a body to die, for all physical activity to cease, and the spirit, soul, or ego to become quite free of its fleshly envelope. We believe that there is an etheric double formed during the life of a body. This double can become a ghost. Probably everyone has looked at a strong light, and on turning away apparently saw the light still. We consider that life is electric, a field of force, and the etheric devil remaining at death is similar to the light one sees after looking at a strong source, or in electrical terms, it is like a strong residual magnetic field. If the body had strong reasons for clinging to life, then there is a strong etheric which forms a ghost and haunts the familiar scenes. A miser may have such an attachment to his money bags that he has his whole focus upon them. At death, probably his last thought will be of fright concerning the fate of his money. So in his dying moment, He adds to the strength of his etheric. The lucky recipient of the money bags may feel somewhat uncomfortable in the small hours of the night. He may feel that old so-and-so is after his money again. Yes, he is right. Old so-and-so's ghost is probably very cross that his spirit hands cannot get a grip on that money. There are three basic bodies. The flesh body, in which the spirit can learn the hard lessons of life. The etheric or magnetic body, which is made by each of us by our lusts, greeds, and strong passions of various kinds. And the third body is the spirit body, the immortal soul. That is our Lamaist belief, and not necessarily the orthodox Buddhist belief. A person dying has to go through three stages. His physical body has to be disposed of, his etheric has to be dissolved, and his spirit has to be helped on the road to the world of spirit. The ancient Egyptians also believe in the etheric double, in the guides of the dead, and in the world of spirit. In Tibet, we helped people before they were dead. The adept had no need of such help, but the ordinary man, or woman, or trapa, had to be guided the whole way through. It may be of interest to describe what happens. One day, the Honorable Master of Death sent for me. It is time you studied the practical methods of freeing the soul, Lobsang. This day you shall accompany me. We walked down long corridors, down slippery steps, and into the trapa's quarters. Here, in a hospital room, an elderly monk was approaching that road we all must take. He had had a stroke and was very feeble. His strength was failing and his auric colors were fading as I watched. At all costs, he had to be kept conscious until there was no more life to maintain that state. The Lama with me took the old monk's hands and gently held them. You are approaching the release from toils of the flesh, old man. Heed my words that you may choose the easy path. Your feet grow cold. Your life is edging up closer and closer to its final escape. Compose your mind, old man. There is nothing to fear. Life is leaving your legs, and your sight grows dim. The cold is creeping upwards in the wake of your waning life. Compose your mind, old man, for there is nothing to fear in the escape of life to the greater reality. The shadows of eternal night creep upon your sight, and your breath is rasping in your throat. The time draws near for the release of your throat. The time draws near for the release of your spirit to enjoy the pleasures of the afterworld. Compose yourself, old man. Your time of release is near. The Lama, all the time, was stroking the dying man from the collarbone to the top of his head in a way which has been proved to free the spirit painlessly. All the time he was being told of the pitfalls on the way and how to avoid them. His route was exactly described, the route which has been mapped by those telepathic lamas who have passed over and continued to talk by telepathy even from the next world. Your sight has gone, old man, and your breath is failing within you. Your body grows cold, and the sounds of this life are no longer heard by your ears. Compose yourself in peace, old man, for your death is now upon you. Follow the route we say, and peace and joy will be yours. The stroking continued as the old man's aura began to diminish even more, and finally faded away. A sudden, sharp, explosive sound was uttered by the Lama in an age-old ritual to completely free the struggling spirit. Above the still body, the life force gathered in a cloud-like mass, swirling and twisting as if in confusion, then forming into a smoke-like duplicate of the body to which it was still attached by the silver cord. Gradually, the cord thinned, and as a baby is born when the umbilical cord is severed, so was the old man born into the next life. The cord thinned, became a mere wisp, and parted. Slowly, like a drifting cloud in the sky or incense smoke in a temple, the form glided off. The Lama continued giving instructions by telepathy to guide the spirit on the first stage of its journey. You are dead. There is nothing more for you here. The ties with the flesh are severed. You are in Bardo. Go your way, and we will go ours. Follow the route prescribed. Leave this, the world of illusion, and enter into the greater reality. You are dead. Continue your way forward. The clouds of incense rolled up, soothing the troubled air with its peaceful vibrations. In the distance, drums were carrying out a rolling mutter. From some high point on the lamasery roof, a deep-toned trumpet sent its message crashing over the countryside. From the corridors outside came all of the sounds of vigorous life, the shh-shh of felt boots, and from somewhere the grumbling roar of a yak. Here in this little room was silence, the silence of death. Only the telepathic instructions of the Lama rippled the surface of the room's quiet. Death, another old man, had gone on his long round of existences, profiting by his lessons in this life, maybe, but destined to continue until he reached Buddhahood by long, long effort. We sat the body in the correct lotus posture and sent for those who prepare the bodies, sent for others to continue the telepathic instruction of the departed spirit. For 3 days this continued, 3 days during which relays of lamas carried out their duties. On the morning of the 4th day, one of the Ragyab came. He was from the Disposers of the Dead colony, where the Lingkor Road branches to Deshenzong. With his arrival, the lamas ceased their instructions, and the body was given over to the disposer. He doubled it up into a tight circle and wrapped it in white cloth. With an easy swing, he lifted the bundle onto his shoulders and strode off. Outside, he had a yak. Without hesitation, he lashed the white mass onto the beast's back, and together they marched off. At the place of the breaking the corpse, the carrier would hand his burden to the breakers of the bodies. The place was a desolate stretch of land, dotted with huge boulders and containing one large, level stone slab, large enough to hold the biggest body. At the four corners of the slab, there were holes in the stone and posts driven in. Another stone slab had holes in it to half its depth. The body would be placed upon the slab and the cloth stripped off. The arms and legs of the corpse would be tied to the four posts. Then the head breaker would take his long knife and slit open the body. Long gashes would be made so that the flesh could be peeled off in strips. Then the arms and legs would be sliced off and cut up. Finally, the head would be cut off and opened. At first sight of the corpse, carrier vultures would have come swooping out of the sky to perch patiently on the rocks like a lot of spectators at an open-air theater. These birds had a strict social order, and any attempt by a presumptuous one to land before the leaders would result in a merciless mobbing. By this time, the body breaker would have the trunk of the corpse open. Plunging his hands into the cavity, he would bring out the heart, at sight of which the senior vulture would flap heavily to the ground and waddle forward to take the heart from the breaker's outstretched hand. The next in order bird would flap down to take the liver, and with it would retire to a rock to eat. Kidneys, intestines would be divided and given to the leader birds. Then the strips of flesh would be cut up and given to the others. One bird would come back for half the brain and perhaps one eye, and another would come flapping down for yet another tasty morsel. In a surprisingly short time, all the organs and flesh would have been eaten, leaving nothing but the bare bones remaining on the slab. The breakers would snap these into convenient sizes, like firewood, and would stuff them into the holes in the other slab. Heavy rammers would then be used to crush the bones to a fine powder. The birds would eat that. These body breakers were highly skilled men. They took pride in their work, and for their own satisfaction, they examined all the organs to determine the cause of death. Long experience had enabled them to do this with remarkable ease. There was, of course, no real reason why they should be so interested, but it was a matter of tradition to ascertain the illness causing the spirit to depart from this vehicle. If a person had been poisoned, accidentally or deliberately, the fact soon became obvious. Certainly, I found their skill of great benefit to me as I studied with them. I soon became very proficient at dissecting dead bodies. The head breaker would stand beside me and point out features of interest. This man, Honorable Lama, has died from a stoppage of blood to the heart. See, we will slit this artery here, and yes, here is a clot blocking the blood flow. Or it may be, now this woman, Honorable Lama, she has a peculiar look. A gland here must be at fault. We will cut it out and see. There would be a pause while he cut out a good lump, and then, here it is. We will open it. Yes, it has a hard core inside. And so it would go on. The men were proud to show me all they could, They knew I was studying with them by direct order of the Inmost One. If I was not there, and a body looked as if it was particularly interesting, they would save it until I arrived. In this way, I was able to examine hundreds of dead bodies, and definitely I excelled at surgery later. This was far better training than the system whereby medical students have to share cadavers in hospital school dissecting rooms. I know that I learned more anatomy with the body breakers than I did at a fully equipped medical school later. In Tibet, bodies cannot be buried in the ground. The work would be too hard because of the rocky soil and the thinness of the earth covering. Nor is cremation possible on economic grounds. Wood is scarce, and to burn a body, timber would have to be imported from India and carried to Tibet across the mountains on the backs of yaks. The cost would be fantastic. Water disposal was not permissible either, for to cast dead bodies into the streams and rivers would pollute the drinking water of the living. There is no other method open to us than air disposal, in which, as described, birds consume the flesh and bones. It differs only from the Western method in two ways. Westerners bury bodies and let worms take the place of birds. The second difference is that in the Western world, the knowledge of the cause of death is buried with the body, and no one knows if the death certificate really has stated the correct cause. Our body breakers make sure that they know what a person died of. Everyone who dies in Tibet is disposed of in this way, except the highest lamas, who are previous incarnations. These are embalmed and placed in a glass-fronted box where they can be seen in a temple, or embalmed and covered with gold. This latter process was most interesting. I took part in such preparations many times. Certain Americans who have read my notes on the subject cannot believe that we really used gold. They say that it would be beyond even an American's skill. Quite, we did not mass produce things, but dealt with individual items as only the craftsman could. We, in Tibet, could not make a watch to sell for a dollar, but we can cover bodies in gold. One evening, I was called to the presence of the abbot, and he said, "A previous incarnation is shortly to leave his body. Now he is at the rose fence. I want you to be there so that you can observe the preserving in sacredness." So once again, I had to face the hardships of the saddle and journey to Sera. At that lamasery, I was shown to the room of the old abbot. His auric colors were on the point of extinction, and about an hour later, he passed from the body to the spirit. Being an abbot and an erudite man, he had no need to be shown the path through the bardo, nor had we need to wait the usual 3 days. For that night only, the body sat in the lotus attitude while lamas kept their death watch. In the morning, at the first light of day, we filed in solemn procession down through the main lamasery building, into the temple, and through a little used door down to secret passages below. Ahead of me, two llamas were carrying the body on a litter. It was still in the lotus position. From the monks behind came a deep chanting, and in the silences, the trill of a silver bell. We had on our red robes, and over them our yellow stoles. On the walls our shadows were thrown in flickering, dancing outline, exaggerated and distorted by the light of the butter lamps and flaring torches. Down we went, down into secret places. At last, some 50 or 60 feet below the surface, we arrived at a sealed stone door. We entered. The room was ice cold. The monks carefully set down the body, and then all departed except three llamas and I. Hundreds of butter lamps were lit and provided a harsh yellow glare. Now the body was stripped of its vestments and carefully washed. Through the normal body orifices, the internal organs were removed and placed into jars, which were carefully sealed. The inside of the body was thoroughly washed and dried, and a special form of lacquer was poured into it. This would form a hard crust inside the body, so that the outlines would be as in life. With the lacquer dry and hard, the body cavity was packed and padded with great care so as not to disturb the shape. More of the lacquer was poured in to saturate the padding and, in hardening, to provide a solid interior. The outer surface of the body was painted with lacquer and allowed to dry. Over the hardened surface, a peeling solution was added, so that the thin sheets of filmy silk, which were now to be pasted on, could later be removed without causing harm. At last, the padding of silk was considered adequate. More lacquer, of a different type, was poured on, and the body was now ready for the next stage of the preparations. For a day and a night it was allowed to remain stationary, so that the final and complete drying could take place. At the end of that time, we returned to the room to find the body quite hard and rigid and in the lotus position. We carried it in procession to another room beneath, which was a furnace so built that the flames and the heat could circulate outside the walls of this room and so provide an even and high temperature. The floor was thickly covered with a special powder, and in this, in the center, we placed the body. Down below, monks were already preparing to light the fires. Carefully, we packed the whole room tightly with a special salt from one district of Tibet and a mixture of herbs and minerals. Then, with the room filled from floor to ceiling, we filed out of the corridor, and the door of the room was closed and sealed with the seal of the lamasery. The order to light the furnaces was given. Soon came the crackling of wood and the sizzling of burning butter as the flames spread. With the furnaces well alight, they would continue to burn yak dung and waste butter. For a whole week the fire raged down below, sending clouds of hot air through the hollow walls of the embalming chamber. At the end of the seventh day, no more fuel was added. Gradually, the fires died down and flickered out. The heavy stone walls creaked and groaned in their cooling. Once more, the corridor became cool enough to enter. For 3 days, all was still, as we all waited for the room to reach the normal temperature. On the 11th day, from the date of sealing, the great seal was broken and the door pushed open. Relays of monks scraped out the hardened compound with their hands. No tools were used in case the body was harmed. For 2 days the monks scraped away, crushing in the hands the friable salt compound. At last the room was empty, except for the shrouded body sitting so still in the center, still in the lotus position. Carefully we lifted it and carried it to the other room, where in the light of the butter lamps we would be able to see more clearly. Now the silken coverings were peeled off one by one until the body alone remained. The preserving had been perfect, except that it was much darker. The body might have been that of a sleeping man, who might at any time awaken. The contours were as in life, and there was no shrinkage. Once again, lacquer was applied to the naked dead body, and then the goldsmiths took over. These were men with the skill unsurpassed, craftsmen, men who could cover dead flesh with gold. Slowly they worked layer upon layer of the thinnest, softest gold. Gold worth a fortune outside Tibet, but here valued only as a sacred metal. A metal that was incorruptible and so symbolic of man's final spirit state. The priest goldsmiths worked with exquisite care, attentive to the minutest detail, so that when their work was finished, they left as testimony of their skill a golden figure, exact as in life, with every line and wrinkle reproduced. Now the body, heavy with its gold, was carried to the Hall of Incarnations, and, like the others there, set upon a golden throne. Hence in this hall there were figures dating back to the earliest times, sitting in rows like solemn judges, watching with half-closed eyes the frailties and failings of the present generation. We talked in whispers here, and walked carefully, as if not to disturb the living dead. To one body in particular I was attracted. Some strange power held me fascinated before it. It seemed to gaze at me with an all-knowing smile. Just then there was a gentle touch on my arm, and I nearly dropped with fright. "That was you," Lobsang, "in your last incarnation. We thought you would recognize it." My guide led me to the next gold figure and remarked, "And that was I." Silently, both much moved, we crept down the hall and the door was sealed behind us. Many times after, I was allowed to enter that hall and study the gold-clad figures. Sometimes I went alone and sat in meditation before them. Each has its written history, which I studied with the greatest interest. Here was the history of my present guide, the Lama Mingyar Dondup, the story of what he had done in the past, a summary of his character and his abilities, the dignities and honors conferred upon him, the manner of his passing. Here also was my past history, and that too I studied with my full attention. 98 gold figures sat here in the hall, in the hidden chamber carved from the rock, and with the well-concealed door. The history of Tibet was before me, or so I thought. The earliest history was to be shown to me later. End of chapter 16.